say, since I'll be going next week, so let's talk a little bit about Hanukkah. So it's just a little early. And first, some history. A lot of times things are fuzzy. A person once asked the rabbi, what was it? I'm trying to remember. Was it? Which was first, the Mikdash Rishon or the Mikdash Sheni? You know, I think that some of the our historical sense is mixed up. We know that Shlomo HaMelech, we talked about this yesterday, Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis HaMikdash 480 years after Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is 440 years after the Jews were in Eretz Yisrael. Right, that's only 440 from Yoshua to the Binyan HaMikdash, and then the Mikdash itself stood for 410 years. Okay, that's what we mentioned, it was 850 years from entering Eretz Yisrael to the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. Now, we know that after Shlomo HaMelech's death, the Jewish people were divided into two nations, the northern kingdom of the ten tribes, and the southern kingdom that was primarily Yehuda and Binyamin, and Kohanim and Levim. And the southern kingdom was ruled by the succession of the Davidic line, the Malchei Beis David. The northern kingdom was ruled by different kings. There was almost never a dynasty. There's a lot of assassinations, etc. Now, the northern kingdom, which is the ten tribes, they were exiled actually more than 100 years before the Chorban Bayis Rishon. And they were never restored. They were never returned. The southern kingdom hung on a little bit for over 100 years till it was destroyed by the Babylonians. Now, Golus Bavel was only 70 years. After 70 years, we were given permission to return to Eretz Yisrael. We built the Bayis Sheni. But here's the thing you have to understand. You have to understand the process of how we return to Eretz Yisrael. Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Bavel, Bavel is modern Iraq, Babylonia. They destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. They exiled the Jews from Eretz Yisrael. But around 52 years after the Churban, the Babylonian Empire was toppled by the Persians. The Persians literally, in a bloodless coup, except for the king who died, except for Belshazzar. Belshazzar was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. Belshazzar was assassinated, and as a result, the Persians just took over the kingdom. Right? The Persia had been spreading its empire throughout the world, and they succeeded to the Babylonian Empire via the assassination of the king, which was an in-house plot, so to speak. Some of the servants agreed. This occurred the night of the very famous handwriting on the wall. Belshazzar, who was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, made a glorious party, celebrating with all of the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash. And in the middle of the party, there is a hand that comes down from the sky. Imagine how scary that was. And he inscribes on the wall four words that nobody could decipher. Menei, menei, takalu parsin. It actually was B'Ksav Ashuris. It was in the Aleph Beis that we have. Menei, menei, your deeds have been numbered, menei. Tikal, you have been weighed and found wanting. Uparsin, and your kingdom shall be divided to the Persians. Nobody could interpret that, but Daniel was able to interpret it, and Belshazzar didn't pay that much attention to it, but that very night, Belshazzar was killed, and his empire went to the Persians. Now, the king of Persia was Cyrus, Koresh. Now, this is 52 years after the Churban, not 70, 52 years after the Churban. 52 years after the Churban, Koresh issues an announcement, a proclamation, giving permission to any Jew who wants to come to Eretz Yisrael to come, and giving them permission to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Right, this is a proclamation of Koresh. This is at the very end of Divrei Hayamim Beis, the very end of Chronicles. This is the very beginning of the book of Ezra. What is very sad is the vast majority of Jews did not respond to that call. Only a small minority went. We're given a number. 40,000 Jews went in response to Koresh's call. Now, we're not sure exactly how many Jews there were, but there were certainly several million Jews in the world at the time. That's fairly well established. And 40,000 is less than 1% of the probable number. But be it as it may, the Jews went back to Eretz Yisrael. But remember, they were not independent. This is very important. They did not have independence. They were a subservient, vassal state to Persia. They were not independent. Only a small minority of Jews went back. Their leader was a man called Zerubbabel. Right? So if you remember the Hanukkah song, Mo'asur, there's a line, Kates Bavel, Zerubbabel. What does it mean, Kates Bavel, Zerubbabel? The end of the Babylonian exile was Zerubbabel, brought us back. And there was great hope. It was thought that perhaps Zerubbabel would be Mashiach. Perhaps this would be the Beis HaMikdash that would never be destroyed. But we were not worthy. We were not worthy. Not enough Jews came back. They didn't care enough to come back. There was a lot of intermarriage in the Book of Ezra. There was intermarriage, Chilul Shabbos, many other things. So as a result, they laid the foundation of the Beis HaMikdash, the Bayis Sheni. There was a great simcha. But it's recorded that old people who had still remembered the first Beis HaMikdash, 70 years before. Well, actually, it's not 70 years. It was only 52 years before. I skipped the story. So what happened was the foundation was laid. But then what happened was the following. What happened was that there were local non-Jewish inhabitants that were jealous of the Jews coming back, like our friends the Arabs, etc. And they slandered the Jewish community to the kings of Persia, stating that they were building a temple as a way of getting a place to rebel and a stronghold and a fortress. And as a result, this is called a sitna. Sitna is a hatred, a hate-filled accusation. And it was, as a result of the sitna, the Binyan Beis HaMikdash ceased after the laying of the foundation for 18 years. Meaning there was none. There was a foundation, there was nothing else. There were no korbanos, there were nothing else. This is a sitna. Now, that is actually when the Purim story happened, because here's the way it works. The first king of Persia was Koresh. When Koresh died, he was succeeded by the Achashverosh of Purim thing. So the story of Purim happened in the 18 years between the return of some Jews to Eretz Yisrael, and we'll see the eventual Binyan Beis HaMikdash. That's why Achashverosh, according to Rashi, Achashverosh even alludes to Esther when he says to Esther all the time, he doesn't know Esther is Jewish, Esther Hamalka, you can have anything you want. I will give you up to half the kingdom. So Rashi brings a medrash, I will give you up to half the kingdom, but I will not give you half the kingdom. Half the kingdom means something in the middle of the kingdom. And that's our tradition that Yerushalayim is the middle of the world. So Achashverosh is playing his bet. Just in case she is Jewish, I got to tell her ahead of time, I'm not going to allow her to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. According to one Chazal, the people who actually instigated the cessation of the Binyan HaBayis were none other than the 10 sons of Haman. They were the ones who sent the letters in the first place, and that stopped the cessation. Now, after Achashverosh died, Achashverosh was succeeded by his son, who is called Darius, or Daryavesh. And it is Daryavesh that permitted the building of the Beis HaMikdash 18 years after Cyrus's decree. Now, if you add 52 and 18, that gives you 70. So indeed, the second Beis HaMikdash, they started to build it in a permanent way 70 years after the Churban. In other words, Koresh's declaration was 52 years after the Churban. They did lay the foundation. There was then a cessation for 18 years, and then they were able to build it. Now, it's interesting, though. So when we say 70 years from Churban to Churban, it's not quite true, because what happened is it took 4 years to build the second Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash was begun in earnest the second year of Darius's reign, but it was completed in the sixth year. So actually, It was completed 74 years from its destruction, but we count from destruction to the beginning of the building of it. And that's 70. That's 70 years. Okay. All right. What is interesting, and this is actually very, very fascinating, that the date in Tanakh that is recorded for the day that the second Mikdash was finished is the 24th of Kislev, the day before Chanukah, which we don't celebrate at all, and it's not connected to the Chanukah holiday, but actually the day before Chanukah is the day of the original dedication of the second Beis HaMikdash. In fact, we'll see if Yaakov Emden actually connects the holiday of Chanukah to this. I'll explain that as we go through. So everyone understands the idea. Now, let me point out that according to Chazal, this Darius II, Daryavish Hasheni, who is the one who authorized the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and in whose reign the Beis HaMikdash was completed, right? It's Achashverosh's son, but Chazal have a Masaira that he was the son of Esther Hamalka and Achashverosh. So that's a delicious irony, because halachically that means Daryavish Hasheni is Jewish, because his mother is Jewish. So the Persian king who allowed the building of the second Beis HaMikdash was in fact a Jew. Now, what we don't know is, we don't know a lot of things. We don't know, was he from? Was he like a secret religious Jew? Did he consider himself Jewish? Again, it's a kind of a tragic aspect from Esther's perspective. It's not clear he considered himself a Jewish person. And if he was Jewish, we don't know if he kept the mitzvahs or not. So we don't know. So in some ways, this is a tragedy in Esther. In fact, the whole being taken by Achashverosh is a tragedy in Esther's life. But nevertheless, her child is the one that enabled the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt. Yep.
The second temple was built and existed entirely while Israel was not in Jewish hands?
That's correct, except for a brief period of the Hasmonean. But so far, it was certainly established when Jews lived, some Jews lived in Eretz Yisrael, many Jews lived in diaspora, but Eretz Yisrael was not an independent state. It was not in Jewish. For the vast majority of the Bayis Sheni, Eretz Yisrael was not an independent Jewish state. It was first ruled by Persia, and then we're going to see Greece, and then we're going to see Rome. The war with Rome was not a war that Rome was attacking us to conquer us, the other way around. The war with Rome was our war to throw off the Roman rule. Rome was ruling over Eretz Yisrael. They were the rulers, yeah.
How is the Persian Empire able to decree that the Beis HaMikdash should be rebuilt?
Why do they have that schuchmi? Well, that's a good question. And in fact, you actually see that it's considered a big, big zechus for Koresh. In fact, the Navi Yeshayahu, now he lived even before the Chorban, but he already was prophesying about the Chorban and the rebuilding, actually calls Koresh, this non-Jewish Koresh, the Mashiach of Hashem, the one that God shows. Why did he have that tzchus? That's a very good question. Although it is interesting that the one that really has the tzchus is Daryavish Hasheni, who's Jewish. So in a sense, they say people talk about the Jewish popes. There are legends. We don't know if it's really true. That, there were Jewish kids who were kidnapped and they were raised Christian, and some of them became clergymen. So they tell a story about one of the popes was in fact, of course, the first pope was definitely Jewish, that we know for sure. The first pope was Peter. he happened to be Jewish. But putting aside the early popes, who probably were Jewish in various ways, but later popes tended not to be, but they have the story in the Middle Ages about a Jewish pope. He served Hashem privately, he put on tefillin, etc., and he tried to do good things for the Jewish people. And a few elections ago, before John Paul II, this was 20, 25 years ago, whatever it was, one of the candidates for the papacy was the Cardinal of Paris, the Archbishop of Paris, who was a cardinal. And the Archbishop of Paris was a Jew. In other words, he was open about it, because what happened was he was placed in a Catholic orphanage during World War II, and he was raised Catholic, but he remembered he was Jewish, although he practiced Christianity, and he was in line, he was one of the big candidates to become Pope. And he openly considers himself a Jewish Christian, whatever that means. It's not sensible. But it says, on the presumed anniversary of his parents' death, he would recite the Mourner's Kaddish. Again, it's all a mix-up here, but this is what he did. Yeah.
Is there any ramification for Daryavish doing what he did and being a mamzer?
Well, Daryavish is not a mamzer. That's a very important thing. Daryavish is not a mamzer because even if we assume Esther is married to Mordechai, as she was, but if a non-Jew fathers a child from a nation's ish, the child is not a mamzer. It's only adultery with a Jewish man that's a mamzer. So Daryavish would not be a mamzer. This idea of Koresh, though, as being Hashem's instrument for the redemption of the Jewish people, is both a bracha to us, but also a bit of a curse. The Gemara says in Brachos, had we been really worthy, the redemption from Babylonia would have been like the redemption of Mitzrayim, with Makos and Nisim and Kriyas Yamsef. Instead, we go by getting permission of a ruling nation to go back. So it's a great thing, but still, we weren't independent, there were no Nisim, it was just, you know, this ruler lets us go back. Right? It's because we were not Roy Lekach in that way. Now, this idea of Koresh, Harry Truman was the president of the United States when Israel was created as a state. And Harry Truman, the State Department, then as now, was very pro-Arab and not pro-Israel. Again, things don't change. And they did not want him to recognize the State of Israel because they thought it would antagonize Arab nations, which of course it did. And the United States was concerned then as now with oil supplies and everything else. But Truman recognized the State of Israel, and since for the remaining 20 years of his life, I think he died in like 1968 or something, he was like a big hero. He was brought to all banquets, Jewish National Appeal. You know, Harry Truman was a big guy, although we've discovered later that he was a bit of an anti-Semite personally, but okay, the Seder, that was relatively common. There were people who did good things for the Jewish people, even though they personally, you know, had problems with Jews, but they were able to separate it out a little bit. It was just a culture, there was like a cultural thing that if you came from the South, you just didn't like Jews that much. But he was able to at least politically not act out on that. In fact, his best friend was a Jewish man. They were business partners. But he never let the best friend come to his house because his wife didn't allow it. His wife was maybe more of the anti-Semite, so she didn't allow Jews. She says, no Jew is going to walk into my house. So that was kind of the attitude in those days. Okay, but anyway, Harry Truman, I think, was told by Rav Aaron Cutler that you are the Koresh, you are the Cyrus of our generation. Hashem puts you as a non-Jew in the role of enabling Jews to come back to the land of Israel. So Harry Truman knew the Bible well, and from that time on, he was really taken with the idea that he was Koresh. So whenever they would introduce him at the Jewish banquets, and they would say, you know, this president did this and that, he would always pull on their coat and say, you forgot to say I'm Cyrus. He was into that title, Cyrus, and the like. Okay. Now, just to fill out something, the great, great tzaddikim, Ezra and Nehemiah, and they established the great assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. They actually came, they were not with Zerubbabel, they actually came shortly after the second Mikdash was dedicated. In the sixth year of Daryavish, we then have Ezra coming with many Jews. And Ezra organized a lot of the religious life. Ezra dealt with intermarriage, with Shabbos. The Anshei Knesset HaGdola made many takanos. They established the Nusach of our Tfilos. They wrote Shemona Esrei. They established Kriyas HaTorah, the mitzvahs of Kriyas HaTorah, which are not Doraisa, except for Parsha Socher. Torah readings are not Doraisa. So they were established by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola and the like. So Ezra and Nehemiah is really the second wave. The first wave was Zerubbabel. Actually, there are three waves, really. The first wave was Zerubbabel all the way back when Cyrus allowed them to come back. Then, 18 years later, Daryavish allowed the building of the Mikdash. Some Jews came back. Ezra and Nehemiah came after the finishing of the Beis Hamikdash. And the Gemara even discusses, gee, why is Ezra such a Johnny-come-lately? I mean, Ezra waits until the Beis Hamikdash is completed. So the Gemara actually says, that Ezra did not want to leave Babel as long as his elderly Rebbe was alive. He wanted to learn from his Rebbe. His Rebbe was Baruch ben Neriah, who was Yirmiyahu HaNavi's Talmud. And therefore, Ezra waited until his Rebbe was Nifter. Okay. All right, so this takes us to the end of the period of Tanakh. This is the end of the biblical period. The history that is recorded in the book, other than Ruach HaKodesh and the like, but the actual history that is recorded in the books of Tanakh ends with Dariush allowing the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt and the dedication of the Second Temple. Right, that is the end of the biblical period. So the biblical period covers the Babylonian exile and the Persian domination, which is only a short period, around 50 years. It does not cover the Greek and Roman periods. The Greek and Roman periods are post-Tanakh. Okay, that's an important thing to remember. Now, in a sense, what makes it post-Tanakh? So why couldn't we continue Tanakh? Why did we have to stop Tanakh? Well, the reason is very simple. In order for a Sefer to be part of Tanakh, it has to be written with prophecy or Ruach HaKodesh. And basically, the last prophets died at the very beginning of the Bayis Sheni. The last prophets are Haggai, these are three Nevi'im that have books in Treyasher, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi got us through the Babylonian exile and the first years of the Beis HaMikdash. But when they died, our tradition is there was no longer Nevuah in Am Yisrael. There were Chachamim. There were Chachamim, right? There were rabbis. There were great people. But the idea of specific divine inspiration was no longer there. And in fact, books were written. In other words, this is called the Apocrypha. Books were written, right after this period. And we know we have some of those books, and we can look at some of those books. But those books do not have the Kedusha of Tanakh because they were no longer written with divine inspiration and Nevuah. That is why the Gemara tells us that Nevuah was taken away, and the only people that have little pieces of Nevuah are children and Shotim. Shotim are mentally crazy people that sometimes Hashem allows them to have bits and fragments of all sorts of divine wisdom, because you're not going to be able to tell, what is divine wisdom and what is craziness. So that's why, it's an old idea that sometimes in Europe there used to be a stock character in every shtetl, every small town, called the Shtut Meshuggener. The Shtut Meshuggener is Yiddish for the town idiot, who, got drunk, whatever. There was like somebody who was like mentally deranged. And in those days, they didn't have psychiatric hospitals, so the people who were crazy just tended to live in the community. They weren't put away. And the Shtut Meshuggener is Meshuggener. But on the other hand, he sometimes says things that are very true that people are afraid to say. It's kind of an aspect of prophecy that the crazy people have, and children as well. Children are more fearless than adults. So they don't have inhibitions, so to speak. So they sometimes see truths that, we don't allow ourselves to see. There's aspects of Nevuah in children and the like. Actually, the Zohar says a fascinating thing. The Zohar says that before a child learns to talk, it's kind of scary, the child has all sorts of understandings which are not communicated. As soon as he gets the power of speech, he loses that capacity, which means the child before he talks is kind of like a prophet. But we're not getting any prophecy because he doesn't tell us as soon as he knows to talk. Yeah. Now, this is a Zohar, the passage of Zohar. Now, it's interesting. I don't know if when you were children you ever read Mary Poppins. But Mary Poppins actually has, I don't know, this mama's the Zohar. I don't know where she got this, where the author got this from. She actually has a kind of an idea that the pre-verbal baby is able to talk to the birds somehow, understands birds and trees and all sorts of things. And the bird is telling the baby, when you're going to talk in a few months, you're not going to be able to talk to me anymore. and the baby starts crying, and the mother doesn't know why the baby's crying. It's mamish, it concedes. Again, I can't say it's built on the Zohar, but it's the same idea, that there's a certain pre-verbal ability to relate to all sorts of different levels that a person loses once they become verbal. Yeah. Well, the getter was that it had to end because of us, meaning to say, nevuah is a consequence of the Shekhinah dwelling in the midst of Bnei Yisrael. And really, because of the Chorban Bayis Rishon, we lost the Zechus of nevuah. But Hashem allowed it to survive a little bit to get us over the Gullus and give us the ability to build again. So really, nevuah fundamentally died as a result of the Chorban Bayis Rishon, but it lingered a little bit through Hashem's chesed. So essentially we lost it. Of course, when Mashiach comes, we'll get it back. But we lost it because we're no longer Zochin. And one has to remember this. The second Beis HaMikdash did not replace the first Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara even has a lashon that the first Beis HaMikdash, you had the Shekhinah there, which is why there was Nebuah. The second Beis HaMikdash didn't have the Shekhinah in that particular sense. The Urim V'Tumim, where the Kohen Gadol could look at the breastplates and determine, you know, answers to questions, you know, the Urim V'Tumim. That only worked in the first Mikdash, not in the second Mikdash, because the Urim V'Tumim is a form of Nebuah. By the way, I just want to clarify, a lot of people make a mistake. I think I told you this, but I'll repeat it briefly. The words Urim V'Tumim do not refer to the breastplate and the jewels. That's called the Choshen. The Urim V'Tumim is like the software. The Choshen is the hardware. The Urim V'Tumim was a piece of parchment that had divine names in it that you would insert between the folds of the Choshen, and this would enable the Choshen to be a prophetic communicator in which the different letters of the tribes would light up. So when we say in the Bayis Sheni there was no Urim V'Tumim, the Kohen Gadol did have a breastplate with the 12 jewels. But the little software package, maybe they had the package, but the software package didn't work anymore. Right? It was had to be updated or whatever it was. Okay? In fact, we have a clear riot from the Gemara in Kedushin, a very famous story that I know you know, that there were these stones of the breastplate during the Bayis Sheni. Do you remember the Gemara in Kedushin? You may have learned this. Discusses the mitzvah of Kibud Aviyim, and it says, if you want to learn who can honor his father correctly, so Esav is an example. And then it gives another example of a non-Jew who is called Dama ben Nesina, who once had a very precious jewel that was needed for the Kohen Gadol's breastplate, but the key to the treasure house was under his father's head, and his father was sleeping, and Dama ben Nesina would not wake up his father to get the jewel, and he was willing to lose whatever it was, millions of shkalim, and that's the Bayis Sheni, right? So they see that they had it. And then the Gemara goes on, in reward for his great devotion to his father, he was zocheh to have a para aduma born in his flock the next year, which also was very expensive because they needed it for purification rituals, and they would pay him any money he asked for, but he just pay me what I would have gotten for the jewel. You don't have to go beyond that. Of course, my kasha on the maisa, that's not our sugya. I mean, to me, that's a very, very difficult maisa, because what's going to happen when his father wakes up? He says, hey, Dad, you're never going to know what I did, and I honor you so much. They were offered us $10 million for that jewel, but I didn't wake you up. I mean, is Dad going to be happy, or is Dad going to be upset? I mean, if your father would want to be woken up, if he really would want to be that you wake him up, l'chaira, it doesn't seem logical that Kibud Aviyim says, don't wake him up. I mean, if your father says, wake me up at a certain time. So l'chaira, if something is a major financial transaction of millions of dollars, it would seem that Kibud Aviyim says, wake up your father. It's a difficult story. To take that story lahalacha, I think would be difficult, because if the actual Shaila came up, let's say you would run to a Rav and say, somebody's offering, $10 million, but I have to, wake up my father. On one hand, it's the same thing as the Gemara, but I think the Rav would pass again. So wake up your father. Okay, maybe not. Okay. All right. So, in truth, the way I understand the Gemara is not giving you a halakha. The Gemara is just telling you, Dhamma was wrong. He was wrong. But, his desire to honor his father was so great that he was willing to give up $5 million. So the Gemara is citing the story not to tell you halakhically how you act, but rather how strong your desire should be to honor your father. Right? Dhamma is not a Talmud Chacham. Dhamma doesn't know the halakha. But out of his own instinct to care for his father, this is how he acted. So Chazal are praising him not for what he did, they're praising him for the instinct that he had. Okay, but be it as may, I'm just quoting that Gemara as a proof that in the Bayis Sheni they did have the Choshen, they just didn't have the Urim V'Tumim, or didn't work, and that's because that's correlated to Nevuah, and the Bayis Sheni we were not Zeicha to Nevuah. Now, in a deeper way, if you want to be even more philosophical, there's a fascinating point that Gra makes. The Gra says the following. I mentioned that Ezra came to Eretz Yisrael shortly after, the year after, the seventh year of Daryavish, the year after the Bayis Sheni was dedicated, the year after. Now, Ezra did a lot of things. Ezra, in fact, the Gemara says, Ezra was as great as Moshe Rabbeinu, that Ezra could have been the one that was Makabel the Torah, but the generation wasn't worthy. Ezra could have done everything Moshe Rabbeinu did. Ezra's an extraordinarily great. So one of the things Ezra did was, Ezra figured that the Yetzer Hara of idolatry was so powerful, and that was the main Aveira that caused the destruction of the first temple, that he thought we would gather all the Jews together and they would pray that Hashem would take away the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah. Which is why we no longer have this Yetzer Hara to bow down to an idol. We don't even understand it. But it was a very powerful Yetzer Hara. And the Gemara says they fasted for 3 days and three nights. And then the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah was taken away. And it even gives us a graphic. It was like a fiery lion leaving the Kodesh HaKadoshim and running into the Judean desert. Now that's pretty peculiar. Avodah Zarah is the worst Aveira. Why would it be pictured as a fire? Okay, fire I understand. It's like a powerful force. That's fine. But why would it be coming out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the holiest place, the Holy of Holies? That's the HR of Avodah Zarah. So, oh yes, just to give you part two of the story, which is kind of a cute story. That is, in a way, this is very unusual. Hashem is taking away Bechira. Normally, Hashem says, you have this HR, struggle with it. Here, Hashem took away the Yetzer Hara, so we don't have it. Because Hashem was maskim, the struggle is too great. So Ezra was actually a little surprised that HaKadosh Baruch Hu acceded to this request. So he figured, wow, gee, we got rid of the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah? Let's get rid of the Yetzer Hara for Gilui Arayos, so people shouldn't have a desire for improper sexual activity. So they pray, and Hashem takes away the Yetzer Hara of Gilui Arayos too. But what happened was, nobody got married. Nobody had children. Hens did not lay eggs. Meaning, the problem is that the sexual urge is needed for marriage, for procreation. You can't, like, take it away from the bad things and not from the good things. You either have the urges, you don't have the urges. So Ezra was mispalel that we get it back again. So the Yetzer Hara of Arayos we still have, but we don't have the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah. Now, the question is, though, why is the HR of Avodah Zarah correlated to a fiery lion in the Kodesh Hashem? This is a long answer to your question. I want to go back why Nevuah was taken away. And the thesis I'm going to share with you is, we lost Nevuah when we lost the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. It is the Yetzer Hara of idolatry that gave us the capacity for prophecy. What's the connection? So the idea is the following. The Rambam says in Hilchos Avodah Zarah that the original origin of Avodah Zarah came from holiness. People had such reverence for God. They had such a deep awareness of Hashem in the world, that they were overwhelmed with awe and trepidation. And they said, I am not worthy to talk to Hashem directly. I will give honor to Hashem by worshiping his subordinates, the sun and the moon. Now, it later degenerated into idolatry, but the Rambam says the original Avodah Zarah was a sense of turning to intermediary powers. And why did they turn to intermediary powers? Because they had such a deep sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's greatness that they did not feel worthy to approach him. Now, which means the netiyah to Avodah Zarah actually came from a holy place, the awareness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But it degenerated into something bad, but that's why it's a holy of holies fire. Now, here's the thing. They used to do surgery, and I don't think they do too much today. They have better ways. But there used to be a surgical procedure called a lobotomy, in which they cut out, you know, if a person has epileptic seizures or whatever it is, they would actually cut out portions of the brain that gives rise to a seizure, right, etc. Now, lobotomies, you can imagine, is a difficult procedure because, as they say, you know, you remove part of the brain that causes seizures, but you might also remove the piano lessons and other things. Meaning to say, a person's overall character is changed, his moods are altered, because you take out one part of the brain, you know, you're taking out other things with it too. You know, we have not, the brain is not so finely segmented. In other words, there's much interaction, intersection. You know, one part is intermeshed with the other part. So it's not possible to kind of disable, like a computer program, I disable one function and keep all the other functions. You change something, you change everything. The Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah, or the nullification, was a spiritual lobotomy. What did God do? God said, if what led you to Avodah Zarah was the awesome awareness of Hashem that you had that paralyzed you, I'm going to take away that feeling. So, how many of us, you know, we may have problems with davening, but I am pretty sure that none of us have this problem. How many people walk into the Beis Medrash, maybe I shouldn't say, I'll talk about myself, and say, I cannot daven today. How dare I approach the Almighty? I'm overwhelmed with his Kedusha, with his purity, with his greatness, with his omnipotence. I am frightened to ask him to show mercy to me because who am I as compared to God? And I can't stop it because I'm overwhelmed with the awesomeness of the Creator. That tends not to be our problem. Maybe we have a problem the other way. Oh, davening is a bother and this and that. My mom is the opposite way. But you see what's going on. The reason we're not attracted to Avodah Zarah today is because we no longer have the Yiras Shamayim that make us feel we're not worthy. So it's a lobotomy. Hashem took out part of our sensibility because it led us to bad places and was dangerous. But as a result, we lost something very, very precious. You see? And that is why the loss of Nevuah, which comes from your awareness of Hashem, was correlated with the loss of the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah, which also meant a diminished awareness of God. And it's precisely because of my diminished awareness, I no longer have the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. Now, Lemaisa, the Vilna Gaon says an interesting thing. The Vilna Gaon says that if we want to know how powerful the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah used to be, when people wanted to connect to God and they felt they weren't worthy, so they were looking for other avenues, the Vilna Gaon says it was replaced by the Yetzer Hara for money and materialism. So he says money, comfort and money became the new Avodah Zarah, so to speak. That's the Avodah Zarah that we have. But that's a Gashmias Avodah Zarah. That's not a spiritual impulse, right? So on a deep level, it is the good and the bad intertwined. The good thing about not having Yetzer Hara Avodah Zarah also means we're less spiritually conscious of things. And as a result, we've lost the capacity of the Lord. Okay? Yeah.
Isn't there a discrepancy of 70 years between the loss of the drive for Vodozara and the loss of prophecy? Because I thought that the Fiery Lion episode occurred around the destruction of the first temple while the temple was still smoldering in ruins. But the prophets...
You know, I'm going to check it. If you remember that, then what I'm saying is not correct. I'm going to have to check it. My memory, and again, I might be wrong. My memory is the other way around. My memory is that the beetle of Avodah Zarah occurred after the dedication of the second temple with the Anshei Knesset HaGdola.
Okay.
And therefore, it actually occurred when, around the time the prophecy was taken, away.
Okay.
But I'll check. You recall it as a pre-Korban event? That's what you think?
I don't remember which Gemara I saw it in, but it was when I was first in Orson Meach and I was in Rabbi Ullman's Gemara Shir. Okay. I actually don't remember which
Gemara. No, okay, it's a Gemara in Yuma. I'll check it. But even if that's so, I don't see it as a 100% question because, as I indicated before, prophecy may have lingered on as a special rachamim of Hashem to tide us over the Golus, right? So it was like a lingering vapor, so to speak. So even if what you're saying is correct, that wouldn't totally undermine what I'm saying, but I believe that it came later, the story did come later. Okay? Okay, so that is why that's the end of the biblical period. So although we do have books, the Book of the Maccabees, for example, is a book that was written shortly after this time, but it is not part of our Tanakh, because, I mean, Chazal had to decide this. Now, Chazal had a whole bunch of books. They had to decide what was B'nevuah, but Chazal were Koveya with their understanding. Non-prophetic, by the way. Their understanding to Torah Shemal Peh, that these were not prophetically inspired books. Okay? So this takes us to the Greek period, because what happened was the following. Darius, and this is confirmed by history, is the last king of the great Persian Empire. Because shortly after Darius's death, I guess there was some successor, I don't even remember his name, but the Persian Empire was conquered by Alexander of Macedonia, who is known in history as Alexander the Great. And by conquering the Persian Empire, he succeeded to the land of Israel as well, which was part of his vast, vast empire. And that begins what we call the Greek domination of Eretz Yisrael. That is around approximately, I get the exact date, around 300 before the Common Era. 300 years before the birth of Yashka, so to speak. And now you may say, well, why is it called Greek? Alexander is from Macedonia, or Macedon. Well, the answer is, Macedonia is a tiny little country even today. There actually is I think it's part of Yugoslavia. Macedonia is a province in Yugoslavia. But the point basically is that Alexander was educated in Greek culture, Greek philosophy, and the like. In fact, just to show you that with money you can get anything, Alexander's private tutor, was Aristotle, who was... the most famous and greatest philosopher of the ancient world, and Alexander had private classes from Aristotle. So with money, I'm sure Aristotle did pretty well on that deal. Alexander's father was the king of the small province of Macedonia. Alexander himself became a world conqueror, conquering the Persian Empire and getting even as far as India. Now, you know, Alexander himself died in his early 30s. He died very young. He was trying to conquer the sub-Saharan Africa. He contracted some plague and he died. And legend has it he died because of the plague, but legend has it, he died out of heartbreak because he was only 30 and he cried and he says, I have no more worlds to conquer. I conquered the whole world. What do I do with the rest of my life and the like? We'll talk about that. So this is already the end of Tanakh, right? Alexander is the beginning of the post-biblical period. Actually, it's the beginning of the period of the Mishnah, as we'll discuss next time, okay? So that's a little, this is all way before Hanukkah. This is kind of a little bit of the pre-Hanukkah narrative, and then we'll continue with the Greek period, and then the Roman period as well, just so we have a sense of how that works. Okay, have a good Shabbos.
Thank you.